Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Here's the story of Cassius Clay, who changed his name to Muhammad Ali. He knows how to talk and he knows how to fight, and all the contenders were beat out of sight. Sing Muhammad, Muhammad Ali. He floats like a butterfly, stings like a bee.
Welcome back to the Career Profiles Podcast. It's been a long time, but we are back and we have a bonus couple of episodes for you before we begin our new season. If you've listened to our season introduction, you will know that we have got one particular episode that we really wanted to do, and that was Muhammad Ali. So this bonus episode is split into two parts. We're going to cover 1942 to 1964, and then from 1964 all the way up until 2016. So sit back and enjoy our definitive episode on Cassius Clay, Muhammad Ali, the greatest, whichever moniker you want to use for this individual. This is going to be one of the greatest episodes that we have ever recorded, and I hope you guys thoroughly enjoy the episode. Johnston, we made this decision to do this episode again because of the fact that we have progressed so much in 4 years as a duo and as a podcast and as a network, and we felt like we wanted to do this even more justice. But there is also the element of the other episodes and the other series that we cover. So Muhammad Ali features in Legendary Nights on more than one occasion. He features in, obviously, his own career profile that we've originally done, but he features in the career profiles of many other fighters that we've covered as well. So there are many stories that we're going to be telling that you may have heard, but what we've tried to do for this two-part episode on Muhammad Ali is actually bring you stories we haven't told yet, stories that you may or may not know, stories that you might have not even realised were out there, and that is certainly something we're excited to do for you guys. So strap yourself in for what is going to be one hell of a ride and a definitive story on Muhammad Ali.
Yes, can't wait. I'm so excited to be doing Muhammad Ali. I mean, he's just a magnificent fighter, a great guy. So many endless stories that we've told, as you said, on so many different platforms that we use. So, yeah, we have been very conscious in making sure we try not to retell those stories, and we will direct you to certain episodes that we've already done that you can go and listen back to if you want a bit more detail. But this is Muhammad Ali in a different light as well. It's one where we want to tell you the story of him from birth all the way, and him as a person, not just the fighter that he became in the ring.
Now, the man known throughout the world today as Muhammad Ali was born Cassius Marcellus Clay Jr. at 6:35 p.m. on January the 17th, 1942, in Louisville, Kentucky. His mother, Odessa Grady Clay, recalled after he was born, "I almost lost him. They put the wrong baby in my bed. I was satisfied it was my baby for a while, but then I noticed that the tag said Brown and not Clay, and I called the nurses. 'Where is my baby?' I asked them. 'This is somebody else's.' They went back and got Cassius. I knew there was something wrong because the other baby was a quiet, nice baby. Once I got Cassius, he cried so much. Cassius would start screaming and hollering, and the next thing, every baby in the ward would be screaming." There will be times during this episode that we will refer to Muhammad Ali as Cassius Clay, but that will stop when he changes his name in 1964. Now, his father, Cassius Marcellus Clay Sr., was a sign painter and an artist, and he said in 1988, That was my living before I had a heart attack. I can't do too much now, but I was an artist, not just a sign painter. His mother, Odessa, worked mostly as a housewife and looked after her two sons, Cassius and Rudolf, also known as Rudy Clay, later renamed Rahman Ali. Now, she occasionally took jobs cooking and cleaning for upper-class white people, and Ali said she would clean house, clean toilets, cook food, take care of babies, all for just $4 a day. One of Odessa's grandfathers was a white Irishman named Abe Grady, who emigrated to the United States from Ireland soon after the Civil War and married a free coloured woman. Young Cassius was raised in reasonably comfortable circumstances, but as Muhammad Ali explained, most of my life in Louisville was one of poverty.
So author Thomas Hauser wrote that Ali's parental grandparents could read and write, and all four of his parental grandparents were listed as free coloured on Kentucky's census rolls. While historical records offer no proof that members of the Clay family were held as slaves, in all likelihood, at one time they were. Ali had something to say about that, and this is what he said. The white side of the family. The fact is that in my part of the family, there was very little knowledge, if any, of white blood from any source. During the days of slavery, slaves become automatically known by the name of their slave holders, whether it be Jones, Williams, Robinson, Smith, Davis, etc. And if slaveholder Clay's blood came into our veins, along with the name, it came by rape and defilement. And after reading the writings of Cassius M. Clay by Horace Greeley, he, as in Ali, or Clay at the time, discovered that he was just as he had predicted, another slave trader who held on to white supremacy. So no wonder he decided to change his name. And as Ali correctly wrote, why should I keep my white slave's master's name visible and my black ancestors invisible, unknown and unhonoured? But let's get back to the story. And although Cassius Sr. was a Methodist, he allowed Odessa to bring up both Cassius Jr. and Rahman as Baptists. And so Cassius Jr. was baptised at the Mount Zion Baptist Church. Ali said this of his mother years later. My mother is a Baptist, and when I was growing up, she taught me all she knew about God. Every Sunday, she dressed me up, took me and my brother to church, and taught us the way she thought was right. She taught us to love people and treat everybody with kindness. She taught us it was wrong to be prejudiced or hate.
Ali also said, my mother, I'll tell you what I've told people for a long time. She's a sweet, fat, wonderful woman who loves to cook, eat, make clothes and be with family. She doesn't drink, smoke, meddle in other people's business or bother anyone. And there's no one who's been better to me my whole life. Clay Sr. said this of his firstborn. He was a good boy. Both them boys, him and his brother, were good boys growing up. They didn't give us any trouble. They were church boys because my wife brought them to church every Sunday. Their mother taught them right, taught them to believe in God and be spiritual and be good to everybody. He was a good child and he grew up to be a good man, and he couldn't have been nothing else, to be honest with you, because of the way his mother raised him. Sunday school every Sunday. I dressed them up as good as I could afford, kept them in pretty good clothes, and they didn't come out of no ghetto. I raised them on the best street I could, 3302 Grand Avenue in the west end of Louisville. I made sure they were around good people, not people who would try to bring them into trouble. And I taught them values. Always confront the things you fear. Try to be the best at whatever you do. That's what my daddy taught me. And those are the things that have to be taught. You don't learn those things by accident. Now we will continue with the theme of allowing Mr. and Mrs. Clay to describe the early life of Cassius, because quite frankly, there's nobody better else to tell the story.
No, not at all. And Odessa actually recalled that we called Muhammad Gigi when he was born because, you know, our babies gibber at the side of their crib. He used to say, Gigi, 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 And then when he became the Golden Gloves champion, he told us, you know what that meant? I was trying to say Golden Gloves. So we called him Gigi, and sometimes I still do. Cassius Jr. used to call his parents Bird and Cash. His mother said he calls me Bird because he says I look like one, pert and pretty. Now everyone calls me that. She continued to explain what Cassius was like as a child. She said he never sat still. He walked and talked and did everything before his time. When he was about 2 years old, he'd wake up in the middle of the night and throw everything from his dresser onto the floor. Most boys run around flat-footed or walk. Gigi went around on his tiptoes all the time. He used to stuff cake in his mouth, and his mouth would be full, and he would still say, more cake, mummy, more cake. And by the time he was four, he had all the confidence in the world. Even when he played with older children, he always wanted to be the leader. He'd tell them, okay, today I'm going to be the daddy. If I had to spank Rudolph, Gigi would run and grab me and say, don't you hit my baby. Everything he did seemed different as a child. He even had measles and chicken pox at the same time. His mind was like the March wind, blowing every which way. And whenever I thought I could predict what he would do, he turned around and he proved me wrong. Nothing changed it, really.
When Cassius attended his local church on a Sunday, he would always sit on the same bench, and on the walls were pictures painted by his father, a job for which he was paid $25 and a chicken dinner. Now Cassius Sr. recalled, my paintings are in most of the churches down here. Almost every Baptist church in Louisville, Kentucky has a mural I had done for them. While sitting on that bench holding his music book and singing hymns, he took the opportunity to carve his initials, CC, into the wood. Initials that remained even when he visited the old church while recovering from a broken jaw in 1973. Cassius Sr. remembered getting his sons to paint, and he said, when the boys got older, I took them with me on jobs. I taught them how to paint pretty good. Before he started fighting, Muhammad could lay out a sign, draw letters, do the spacing, mix the paint, and fill it in right. On the outside, the family did seem almost perfect, but Louisville police records do reveal that Cassius Clay Sr. was arrested 4 times for reckless driving, 2 for disorderly conduct, 1 for disposing of mortgage property, and 2 for assault and battery. His desire for women led to a disagreement at the family home, and he would sometimes turn violent under the influence of alcohol. On 3 occasions, Odessa called the police for protection from her husband. However, Ali conclusively said in his book, The Greatest, My Own Story, my father raised his children like my grandfather had raised him. We were not to be struck by anyone inside the house or outside.
Growing up on the South, where racism was pretty much accepted, segregation was common. It weren't easy for the family. And Rockman Ali recollected that Louisville was segregated, but it was a quiet city, very peaceful and clean. There wasn't much crime, no drugs, very little drinking or prostitution. Things were different from the way they are now. Ali called it Black Louisville, which is divided into 3 sections. The worst is East End, and we call it Snake Town. The California area is the better section and the most populated in the West End where I grew up. Rockman Ali said, growing up, the only problems Muhammad and I had with whites were if we were walking in a certain part of town. If we were in the wrong place, white boys would come up in a car and say, hey nigger, what are you doing here? I never got into any fights. No one attacked me. It wasn't like in the Deep South, but people would call us nigger and tell us to get out if they thought we were someplace we didn't belong. It was a white someone who actually really affected a young Cassius, and Odessa recalled that on one occasion, he was actually denied a drink of water at a store. She said they wouldn't give him one because of his colour, and that really affected him. Ali gave his opinion on what it was like to be living in Louisville, Kentucky, and in the late 40s and early 50s. He said, when I was growing up, too many coloured people thought it was better to be white. And I didn't know what it was, but I always felt like I was born to do something for my people.
Ali continued and said, 8 years old, 10 years old, I'd walk out of my house at 2 a.m. and look up at the sky for an angel or a revelation or God telling me what to do. I never got an answer. I'd look at the stars and wait for her voice, but I never heard nothing. Then my bike got stolen and I started boxing. And it was like God telling me that boxing was my responsibility. God made us all, but some of us are made special. Einstein wasn't an ordinary human. Columbus wasn't an ordinary human. Elvis Presley, the Wright brothers. Some people have special resources inside, and when God blesses you to have more than others, you have a responsibility to use it right. By 1950, some universities started admitting black students, but by 1955, when Cassius was 13, segregation of housing in Louisville was banned because of a suit by the National Association for the Advancement of Coloured People, known at the time as the NAACP. It was in that year that young Cassius and a friend took out their frustration on the brutality of racism by vandalising a local rail yard. Years later, Ali's daughter, Hannah, wrote that Ali once told her, "Nothing would ever shake me up more than the story of Emmett Till." Now, Emmett Lewis Till was a 14-year-old African-American boy who was abducted, tortured, and lynched in Mississippi in 1955 after being accused of offending a white woman, Carolyn Bryant, in her family's grocery store. The brutality of his murder and the fact that his killers were acquitted drew attention to the long history of violent persecution of African-Americans in the United States. Till would subsequently become an icon of the civil rights movement, and young Cassius will never forget him, and he said, "I couldn't get Emmett out of my mind."
A year later, Louisville schools, they began integrating. However, an angry mob of Sturgis High School students had had a madness with 8 black students, which led to Governor Chandler sending in the state police and National Guard to protect them from the violence. So it's just a full-scale racial war, if you like, or whites just beating up black people, because that's what was happening. And in 1957, the Kentucky High School Athletic Association allowed participation of black schools in its state's tournament, so basketball. You see that in some of the films. And all during which time Cassius was attending the Central High School in Louisville. So he had been going through all this segregation and now all of a sudden integration, which wasn't easy. And it was later discovered that he was dyslexic, which means that he had difficulties in reading and writing. And this would have been difficult for him during his school years and later in life when he needed to read and sign professional contracts and even when he went to draft in the military, which we'll come to. A year before Emmett Till's murder, Cassius Clay's bike was stolen. Ali already alluded to it earlier. Well, here's the story. This is the whole story. The saga of the stolen bike has been told often over time, and we're sure you know about it. If you know about Ali, you know about the bike. But we can't not mention it. So Cassius would suffer a misfortune that would change his life forever. When one day, on October 1954, at the age of 12, he went to the local market with one of his friends. Cassius rode his new bike, a $60 red and white Schwinn, of which he was extremely proud of. After parking their bikes, Cassius and his friend wandered around the marketplace, just killing some time and enjoying free popcorn and ice cream. But when they decided to head home, Cassius discovered that his new bike was gone. He was, of course, pissed off and upset, and Cassius went to see a local police officer. His name was Joe Martin, who was operating at a basement boxing gym in their neighbourhood, and demanded that the police search for his bike. And in a fury, Cassius Clay swore that he would beat up whoever was responsible for stealing his bike. And at that point, Martin suggested that it might be a good idea for Cassius to learn to box before setting out on the thief's trail, and offered some boxing lessons.
Joe Martin explained and said, "I was down at the gym one night and there was something else going on in the building, a display of merchandise that the Negro merchants put on once a year for their customers. And one night this kid came downstairs and he was crying. Somebody had stolen his new bicycle, and of course he was very upset about that and wanted to report it to the police. Someone told him, there's a police officer downstairs in the gymnasium. Go down and tell him about it. He was having a fit, half crying because someone stole his bike. He was going to whoop whoever stole it. And I brought up the subject and I said, well, you better learn how to fight before you start challenging people that you're going to whoop. Soon, Cassius began training at Martin's gym and he learned quickly. He showed great speed and athletic prowess. Before he knew it, he was a regular at the gym, and within 6 weeks he had his first amateur fight, weighing in at 89 pounds. Cassius fought another 12-year-old called Ronnie O'Keefe. He did just enough to win by a split decision and greeted the announcement of his victory by claiming that he was going to be the greatest in the world. Even Cassius Sr. shouted, this is going to be the next world heavyweight champion. Let's get ready for it. Get down to business. I've got another Joe Lewis. Ali recalled, I'd only had one fight and it startled me. When my father believes something, he dramatised what he believes. Martin, on the other hand, said at first he was just ordinary, and I doubt whether any scout would have thought much of him in his first year. About a year later, though, you could see that little smart Alec. I mean, he's always been sassy. He had a lot of potential.
Well, mine also said, he stood out because I guess he had more determination than most boys, and he had the speed to get him someplace. He was a kid willing to make the sacrifices needed to achieve something worthwhile in sports. I realised it was almost impossible to discourage him. He was easily the hardest worker of any kid I ever taught. Clay displayed remarkable self-discipline with his training, running for miles in the early morning and going to the gym and sparring after school. He even never had enough money for a bus, and he used to run from one bus stop to the next trying to beat the bus. Ali recalled his start in boxing and how he avoided other temptations. He said, Joe Martin was the man who started me in boxing, but sometimes I trained with a black man named Fred Stoner. I trained 6 days a week and never drank or smoked a cigarette. The only thing I ever did like drugs was twice I took the cap off a gas tank and smelled the gas, which made me dizzy. Boxing kept me out of trouble. It kept him out of trouble and away from all other sports too. And his brother, Ratman Ali, even admits this. He said, Muhammad and I had a few fights between us. All brothers do. But it was nothing serious, more like tests of strength, wrestling. He always had to be the leader. And we let him because he was very intelligent and quick. Outside of boxing, he never played much sports. Now and then, we would play touch football on the street, and he was fast. He was hard for the rest of us to get to him to make the tag because of his speed. But tackle football, he didn't like. He wouldn't play because he thought it was too rough. But he was great at marbles, apparently. He loved to shoot marbles as well as, obviously, train and box.
Rahman Ali then explained that Cassius used to ask me to throw rocks at him. I thought he was crazy, but he'd stand back and dodge every one of them. No matter how many times I threw, I could never hit him. His mum noticed that boxing made him even more confident, and she said, he had confidence in himself, and that gave me confidence in him. He started boxing when he was 12, and we'd sit at night and he'd tell me how someday he was going to be the champion of the world. It made me nervous watching him in the ring, but I believed that he could take care of himself. Every fighter will suffer adversity at some point, but it's about what you do after that that can mould you into a stronger fighter and a tougher human being. And Joe Martin recalled one hardship early in young Cassius's amateur career, and he said, only once did I ever see him knocked out, knocked cold, and that was in the gymnasium, working out with an amateur named Willie Moran. Now, Moran was a good hitter, and he really flattened Cassius that day. Cassius had been talking to me about wanting a scooter, and when he regained consciousness, he said to me, "Mr. Martin, which way was that scooter going that hit me?" The scooter was on his mind. Now, boxing was also on his mind, and he was also determined to not let the knockout stop his dream, and Joe Martin said, "That was the only time I ever saw him knocked cold, and it didn't faze him. He was back working out with Moran again the next day." Now, as Cassius continued to develop, Joe Martin would book him on his Tomorrow's Champions bill, which was aired on television. He was supposed to fight another kid who was a bit older, but the fight was scrapped due to weight issues, and Cassius lost out on his usual payment of $4.
Well, Cassius and this other kid, they were both gutted when they ironically bumped into each other in the street. And Ali recalled that, "I walked over to him. You Jimmy Ellis, you Cassius Clay, why don't you gain some weight?" I say, as if being skinny's his fault. Tears in his eyes. "We both lost $4 because you're too skinny. We lost $4 because you're too heavy," he shouts back. "You're too young to weigh that much." Well, later, they will fight in an amateur tournament. Ellis wins one and Clay wins one, and they will have their final rubber match as professionals. Ellis would go on to be a sparring partner for Muhammad Ali and go on to win a version of the heavyweight world title. Cassius had a usual routine from about 14 to 16, and this is what he explained. He said, "After school, I would work 4 hours for the Catholic Sisters, then train at Martin's gym from 6 to 8 in the evening. From there, I would go and get the real training at Stoner's gym from 8 to 12 at night." It was Fred Stoner's gym that Clay really began to develop, and he explained the fine details that he had taught him. He said, "Fred was relentless in making me develop certain muscles which he believed were necessary for survival in the ring. He made us shoot left jabs, 200 straight, sharp left jabs at a time without stopping. If we got tired, he made us start all over and count to 100, 1, 2 and 3, shooting jabs until we could do the 200 without failing it. Then he made us shoot and jab and a right cross." So he's teaching them jab, 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 and now he's brought in the right cross. "Then come back with a hook, a left hook, and duck and jab and back up and jab and move forward." I mean, he still remembered all this. It's amazing. "And he taught us to block, to shoot right crosses, and we went over it again and again. We did 100 press-ups and 100 knee bends."
Ali made no bones about who developed him as a fighter, and he wrote, "All the publicity about my boxing origin and the early development of my boxing skill describes Joe Martin as the incubator, but my style, my stamina, my system were melded down in the basement of a church in East End, Fred Stoner's gym. Now, away from the ring, there was a bully called Corky Baker who ran the streets, and Ali recalled that he terrorised everyone, including me, and he beat up everyone, including me. Young Clay had several run-ins with Corky and admitted to losing every time. But one day, when he was feeling even more confident, he bragged about how he might beat him in the ring, and word got back to the tough street fighter. In the end, a fight was agreed to take place in the gym and not on the streets, which suited Clay. It was a 3-round bout, and the winner would be recognised in Louisville as the real champion fighter. Corky was tough, short and stocky, but was no match for Cassius, who had now perfected the art of leaning back, circling and jabbing. Corky swung wildly, missed wildly, and eventually quit. He stomped out of the ring, into the dressing room, got his clothes on and left the gym. Ali remembered, "My classmates from Central High shouted and jumped for joy, lifted me up on the shoulders and shouted, 'The king is dead, we're all free now.' I was the new king of both the gym and the streets. It was a victory of no financial importance, but when I was 16, the battle with Corky Baker was big. It told me something I needed to know." On his return home in 1973, Ali discovered that Corky had been killed just a week before the first Ken Norton fight after he was involved in a shootout with the police in a tavern.
So on March the 31st, 1958, Clay voluntarily withdrew from Central High School. In the 1957-1958 school year, Clay got poor grades, receiving a 65 in English, 65 in American History, 70 in Biology, and a 70 in General Art. Clay re-entered Central High School in September of 1958 and remained until he graduated on June the 11th, 1960. He ranked at 376 out of a graduating class of 391. His average grades for the 9th, 10th, 11th, all the way up to the 12th years was 72.7. Now, Cassius devoted all his energies to boxing, fighting in 108 amateur bouts, winning 6 Kentucky Golden Glove Championships, 2 National Golden Gloves tournaments, and 2 National AAU titles by the time he was 18. Clearly more interested in boxing than school, but that is important to mention the grades there because of the fact he has tests to go to the Vietnam War, which we're going to come to. Fantastic amateur, clearly. Still, he was unknown to the larger public, even though he had all those titles. In those years as an amateur, Cassius has watched great fighters on television, like Gene Fulmer, Carmen Basilio, Archie Moore, and Floyd Patterson. There were particular fighters that he identified and watched, and all took punishment in the ring. But he never understood it. He never understood why a fighter would want to fight that way. He understood the science of sport. As he said it, hit and don't get hit. Easy to say, but unbelievably hard to implement. Wiley explained, he said, "Soon I developed a built-in radar. I know how far I can go back when it's time to duck or time to tie my man up. I learn there is a science to making your opponent wear down. I learn to put my head within hitting range, force my opponent to throw blows, then lean back and away, keeping eyes open so I can see everything and then sidestep, move to the right or to the left, jab him again and then again, put my head back in hitting range. It takes a lot out of a fighter to throw punches that land in thin air. When his best combinations hit nothing but space, it saps him."
Although just a young man, Clay knew the importance of defence, and he said, "Throughout my amateur days, old boxers think I'm easy to hit, but I'm not. I concentrate on defence. I concentrate on timing and motions and pulling back. When I throw a jab, I know my opponent will throw a punch and I pull back." Chuck Bodak was part of the Golden Gloves coaching staff for the Chicago Tribune, and he said that Cassius lost in his first year in a National Golden Gloves tournament to a kid named Kent Green, who was an older, seasoned amateur from Chicago. But Cassius had talent, he made an impression, and each year after that, the improvement was obvious. The more he matured, the sharper he got. I mean, you'd have to be blind not to see how good this kid was. I told his mother once, "Cassius must be from outer space because I've never seen anyone like him in my life." Bob Schurkine, an amateur athletic union referee and judge, agreed with Bodak's memoirs. He said, "I saw him with his hands down standing there, looking like he was going to get bombed out, and then all of a sudden, realising that God had given this kid reflexes like no one had ever seen." He also remembered staying at a hotel for a tournament out of town. The next morning, after Clay had knocked out his opponent in the first bout the evening before, he was trying to find the sports pages in the newspapers, but they were all missing, and said, "I know where the damn sports sections are." So I went up to Cassius's room, and he was sitting there on the floor with a pair of scissors, cutting his picture out of all the sports sections where it had been that day. But he was always a likeable youngster.
Well, Bob liked him so much, he actually carried a picture in his wallet of him and Clay together when he was 17 years old. He said this of young Clay. He said, "When we were training at Fox Dicks for the Olympics, we went to Atlantic City for a day just to relax. We're walking along the boardwalk and he was so innocent, so in awe of everything. He looked out to the ocean and said, 'Man, that's the biggest damn lake I've ever seen.'" In 1957, Clay introduced himself to legendary trainer Angelo Dundee, who remembered the moment. So he said, "We were in a hotel room watching television in Louisville when the phone rang, and it was this kid saying, "Mr. Dundee, my name is Cassius Marcellus Clay. I'm the Golden Gloves champion of Louisville, Kentucky." And he gave me a long list of championships he was planning to win, including the Olympics and the heavyweight championship of the world. And then he said he wanted to come up to the room to meet us. I put my hand over the mouthpiece and said to his fighter, Willie Pastrano at the time, he said, "There's a nut on the phone and he wants to meet you." Zali was a huge fan of Willie Pastrano. And Willie said, "What the heck? There's nothing good on television." So a few minutes later, the kid was in the room with his brother, Rudy. Both of them were handsome, well-mannered boys. Mostly, we talked about boxing. And they stayed for 3 or 4 hours. Then in 1959, they met again when Pastrano was fighting a guy called Alonzo Johnson in Louisville. And Dundee said, "This time, Cassius came to the gym and asked if he could spar with Willie." Now, I don't like pro sparring with amateurs. It's not a good way to get someone hurt. But Willie was willing and figured, why not let him go around?
Dundee remembered that Cassius was 17. Willie was a professional on his way to winning the light heavyweight championship of the world. And I gotta tell you, Cassius won that round. By the age of 18, Clay, who was fighting in the light heavyweight division, had developed into a brilliant and promising amateur. So it was no surprise when his next stop would be the 1960 Olympic Games. Although, after prevailing in the Olympic trials, Clay almost didn't go to Rome. The reason was that he was terrified of flying, and when he eventually boarded the plane, he insisted on wearing a parachute during the flight. Joe Martin explained and said, "We had a rough flight going to California for the trials, and so when it came time to go to Rome, he said he wasn't going to fly, and that he wouldn't go. And I said, well, you'll lose the opportunity of being a great fighter. And he said, well, I'm not going to go. He wanted to take a boat or something. I finally took him out to Central Park here in Louisville, and we had a long talk for a couple, or maybe 3 hours, and I calmed him down and convinced him, if he wanted to be heavyweight champion of the world, that he had to go to Rome and win the Olympic Games. Just before Clay left for Rome, he remembered, when I was a kid, my hero was Sugar Ray Robinson. I finally got the chance to meet him in 1960 when I was on my way to the Olympics. He was coming out of a hotel and I ran up and introduced myself and asked for an autograph. But he said, not now, kid. I'm busy. I went back to my hotel and cried. And I told myself I never wanted to disappoint a kid the way Sugar Ray Robinson disappointed me."
Wow, that's sad, actually. He didn't really love kids, didn't he? When Clay arrived in Rome, he became the premier attraction of the Olympic Village. He was strutting around and boasting about his glittering future. And, well, he backed up his words because Clay breezed his way into the light heavyweight gold medal, winning his first 3 fights in the 178-pound division, scoring 2 unanimous decisions, and a second-round knockout. Now, then in the finals, he faced a Polish fella that I am just not going to pronounce his name. I'll give it a go. No, I'm not, actually. My advice is, if you want to know the Polish guy that Cassius Clay fights in the Olympics, go and have a look yourself. He's Polish. He was a 3-time European champion and bronze medalist from the 1956 Olympic Games. So there you go. So Clay was behind on points after 2 rounds. And he explained afterwards that, "I knew that I had to take the 3rd round big to win the gold." And that is precisely what he did, drawing blood from the southpaw Polish fella and almost stopping him. In the end, the judges made Clay the winner on points and the gold medal was his. Those who saw him perform were struck by his speedy footwork, which was unusual for a man of his size. After a brief stay in New York, after Rome, so he's gone to New York, where he met his potential manager, who was a millionaire guy, this fellow, William Reynolds. Clay returned to a welcoming crowd at the Louisville airport. There was a parade that followed after as well. But this significant memory of the summer of 1960 was, as he put it, not the hero welcome, the celebrations, the police chief, the mayor, the governor, or even the 10 Louisville millionaires But that night when I stood on the Jefferson County Bridge and threw my Olympic gold medal down to the bottom of the Ohio River, and I felt no pain and no regret, only relief and a new strength. And we're going to go into exactly why Ali felt like that. Now, Clay loved that gold medal. We can't even tell you how much he loved that gold medal, winning it. He wore it everywhere, he even wore it to bed. But he soon realised that being an Olympic champion, well, it meant nothing in his hometown. It meant nothing at all. But we will come to that soon. Clay initially refused to team up with, Clay initially refused to team up with this Mr. Reynolds, who was this millionaire, even though the contract that was offered to him, getting off that plane in Rome, was a very lucrative one indeed.
His refusal was due to how other white people around his prospective manager had treated him, like just another houseboy, as he recalled. Clay wanted to be different, more independent. The contract that Joe Martin offered him was very poor, and he remembered, "It guaranteed me $75 a week for 10 years. I wanted to take it because I was making so little money at the time. And my father screamed, 'Nobody buys my son for $75 a week for 10 years. The slave trade is over.' And he told Martin what to do with the contract." Clay said Martin blamed the rejection on Dad's hatred for white policemen. And we shared that version of the story with you in our Legendary Nights episode, The Tale of Liston versus Clay. Now, initially, Clay decided to pursue a manager of his choice, and he said, "When I came home from Rome, Joe Louis would have been my first choice as manager. But Louis didn't like to talk much, didn't like loud-mouthed bragging fighters, and predicted that I would lose every fight I had." Even though Clay was disappointed with his hero Ray Robinson before the Olympics, he still decided to approve him about being his trainer, and he remembered, "I wanted Sugar Ray Robinson and went to New York to search for him and offer myself as a prospect. Ray was near the end of his career and I thought he might like to handle mine. When I finally cornered him and forced him to notice me, he brushed me off. 'Look, kid, come back maybe in a couple of years, okay?' All day I followed him around Harlem, dancing, jabbing, shadow boxing, showing him how fast, how quick I was. Ray was just too busy. Years later, when we became friends, he would shake his head sadly over what might have been if he had taken me on."
Clay said, "Now looking back, I'm glad he didn't. I respect Sugar Ray in the ring as one of the greatest of all times. But he stayed out of what I call the real fighting ring, and the one where freedom for black people in America takes place. And maybe if he had become my manager, he might have influenced me to go his way. And I'm glad he had no time." He received offers as well, Clay. Offers to manage him from Archie Moore, Rocky Marciano and Custy Amato. But it was Cassius Sr. who stepped in and directed his son to a team of wealthy Louisville businessmen. And he said, "I got him a good contract with people that could promote him. I'm responsible for his starting outright. All sorts of people were talking big, but nobody really backed it up the way I thought they should, except for the Louisville sponsorship group. They were a collection of 11 white men, 10 of whom were millionaires or heirs to old line Kentucky fortunes. A former investment counselor and vice president of Brown Foreman Distillers Corporation, William Faversham, he was the 11th member who brought the group together. So Faversham estimated the cost of launching Cassius Clay as a professional boxer at $25,000 to $30,000. Accordingly, each member of the syndicate was asked to pay $2,800, except for Faversham, who was given $1,400 discount for his organizational efforts. Now, Thomas Hauser explained the deal in excellent detail. Some saw the syndicate as a chance to make money. Others were guided by the desire to safeguard a local hero or simply have a bit of fun. Regardless, the contract signed by Cassius Clay and consigned by his parents was fair and generous for its time. Clay received $10,000 sign-on bonus and for the first 2 years, a guaranteed draw of $333 a month against earnings.
Hauser explained, the sponsoring group had options to extend the contract for up to four additional 12-month periods. Earnings would be split 50-50 for the first 4 years and 60-40 in Clay's favour thereafter. All management, training, travel and promotional expenses, including a trainer's salary, would come out of the syndicate's end, and 15% of Clay's income would be set aside in a pension fund, which he could not touch until he reached the age of 35 or retired from boxing. They would continue to work with Clay for 6 years, but from a distance, and he explained, following that first contract session, I caught glimpses of them, mainly at my fights as I sat on my stool waiting for the bell to send me out for the next round. One or two of them would wave at me from their ringside seats, or wave a cigar, or nudge a girlfriend or an associate as though saying, that's our horse. No matter how successful Clay had been in the Olympics, and that he had just signed a professional contract, to many, he was just another black kid. The realisation of this horrible truth showed its ugly head one cloudy afternoon when he went to visit a downtown Louisville restaurant with his good friend, Ronnie King. A gang of bikers were already in this restaurant. Cassius and Ronnie knew a couple, Kentucky Slim and their leader, Frog. They sat down at the counter and asked for two hamburgers and two vanilla milkshakes. But as the waitress returned to the kitchen, a big fat white man motioned for her to come and see him. She later returned and said, we can't serve you here. Cassius politely replied, Miss, I'm Cassius Clay, the Olympic champion. And he showed her his Olympic gold medal.
Well, without hesitation, the waitress rushed over to the owner to tell him who it was. But without even turning around, he replied, I don't give a damn who he is. I done told you, you don't serve no niggers. Ali later recalled how a deathly silence filled the air. He said, my heart was pounding. A minute before, this had been a noisy, chatty place with 30 or more customers. I pushed away from the counter. Ronnie went through every motion with me, as though we'd rehearsed the act. I stood up. Knives, forks and chit-chat stopped, and all eyes were on me. My mouth felt hot and dry. Never in 100 fights did I feel blood rush into my head as it did then. He had an overwhelming desire to fight, and he recalled the owner, arms folded, his huge stomach bulging over his apron tie, started out from around the counter as if to give me a personal message. He remembered backing off, and then, as he said it, for an instant I had an urge to dig a right cross to the pit of his stomach, then a left hook to his mouth, and then follow up with an uppercut. And to this day, I wonder if I shouldn't have obeyed that urge. I think he should have just done it. Well, his brain rushed with all sorts of things at this split moment, but he couldn't find the right words, and he recalled the motorcycle gang had taken a sudden interest in the action, and some walked down to where the owner was and leaned against the counter. I saw Ronnie move his head to his right side pocket, where he kept a pearl-handled switchblade, a long, wicked weapon that he had taken from a dying pimp, Jailhouse Sydney Green. Meanest pimp I ever seen. You take the owner, I take Frog, he whispered, and I shook him off.
Ronnie then kept repeating that Clay was the Olympic champion, but his words fell on deaf ears, so he convinced Cassius to call them sponsors for some assistance. He called one, Mr. Sutcliffe, but froze on the phone and said nothing. Ali explained why, and he said, I did not want to be considered their boy, even in the eyes of those who hated me. I had earned my gold medal without their permission. It should mean something without their permission. I wanted that medallion to mean that I owned myself. And to call seemed to me to be exchanging one owner for the other. And suppose they did come to my rescue. Then I could come and go in the white-only places, but other blacks couldn't. Then what would I be? Clay and Ronnie left the restaurant and were then approached by the biker gang. Ali explained that Slim spoke to him and said, Frog wanted to lynch y'all there in the restaurant, but I said no. No, let y'all go back to where you belong. Just give Frog some lil old souvenir like something. I understood exactly what he wanted, and I remembered feeling tight and warm as though the bell had rung for the round. We're fresh out of souvenirs. Then Slim pointed to my neck. Frog wants that ribbon and the medal for his girl. Lil souvenir like. And you, kin, go on about your business. What y'all say? And Ronnie replied, Slim, go tell Frog. We'll give it to his mother in trade. See you later, Slim. I gunned my bike. Flushed and furious, Slim shook a prophetic finger at me and raged, Frog gun kill you niggers for that. You wait, you black bastards, you wait. Clay and Ronnie sped off on the motorbikes, knowing that the gang would follow them, and headed off the Jefferson County Bridge.
So when they reached the bridge, Rowali explained what happened when the biker gang caught up with them. In his own words, he said, with perfect timing and in a coordinated move, Ronnie leaped off his machine, hurling it with all his strength underneath Frog's front wheel. Frog saw it too late, made a frantic jerk, cut to the left, skidded up against the cement mortar, smashing himself and his woman onto the bridge column. The woman let out a painful scream, badly hurt and bleeding, her blouse ripped. She scrambled over to help Frog, who hung dazed against the rail. Kentucky was coming up behind him, whirling the same kind of chain, aiming at my head. Then and there occurred one of the two split-second moves in my life, without which my career would have been forever altered. The second happened during my first championship fight with Sonny Liston. The first was here on Jefferson County Bridge. Slim whipped his doubled-up chain at my head. Instead of slashing my face, the chain wrapped around my shoulders. Instinctively, I shot my hand out and gripped the chain and jerked with all my might. The force snatched Slim off his hog and held us together in a violent impact. His head struck mine and stunned me, but not enough to stop me from smashing my fist into his face. His body hit the ground, blood spurted from his nose, his empty hog careered off the rail. Now meanwhile, this is going on, Ronnie had a half Nelson around Frog's neck and he was choking him, his blotted face even more distorted by the veins popping from his temples, as Arlie put it. The switchblade was pressed against his throat. Get back, or I'll cut his goddamn neck off. Get back. He started ripping Frog's leather jacket as though it was tissue paper. I shouted to the girl, tell him stay off the bridge. Get him off the bridge.
As the gang backed away and then edged forward, Clay told Ronnie, lighten up. Let Frog talk. Frog screamed a throaty, desperate gurgle. I done told y'all, gone back. Gone back home. You too, Slim, gone. Slim pulled himself together like a drunkard and limped with his machine back to his battalion. They consulted briefly, looked up at us, and then slowly retreated down the street. I didn't move. I just watched until I heard the girl crying. They gone now. What you gonna do with us? Clay and Ronnie assisted Frog and his girlfriend so they could get on their way. Ali recalled. We stood there until they disappeared, until all we could hear was rain and the shuffle and rattle of trains on the Kentucky side. Better get the hell away from here. Ronnie was wiping his knife on his sleeve like a violin bow. My bike's wrecked. He surveyed what was left of it, a mass of twisted metal. Then something about my face must have stopped him, and he said, you hurt? God damn, they got you. I shook my head. Physically, I had come off better than I expected, but the miserable pain in my head and stomach that I felt in the restaurant had returned. Give and take punches, like the blows exchange with Frog's battalion, are bearable, but I was feeling the after effects of the blows I'd taken from the restaurant owner, and the mayor, and the millionaires. Now if you never understood why Ali decided to throw his Olympic gold medal in the Ohio River, then his version of events at the restaurant and the fight with the biker gang gives you a pretty good reason. Straight after the incident, he said, "For the first time I saw it, as in the gold medal, as it was. Ordinary. Just an object. It had lost its magic."
Craig continued that suddenly I knew what I wanted to do with this cheap piece of metal and raggedy ribbon. And as soon as I knew, the pain in my stomach eased. That was it. He chucked it in the river. His mate, Ronnie, was pissed. Like, give it to me. Don't throw it away. He loved it. But you understand it. It was an object. Made him feel better. The racism he had endured and the potential damage he could have received resulted in Clay having an epiphany. He was also preferring the teachings at this time, which is something not many people know, of the Nation of Islam, although he wasn't yet confident enough to speak about it. The teachings had interested him from when he was at school. He avoided pork because he said it made his blood pressure rise, but perhaps because Islam forbids it. He wanted Mildred, who was his girlfriend at the time, he told her to wear longer dresses, and he wanted to write his school essay about the movement. The foundations of what he would become were now beginning to emerge. Clay began training with one of his old amateur trainers, Fred Stoner, and he would be in his corner for his first ever professional boxing match against a guy called Tunny Hunsaker. On October the 29th, 1960, 3 days after signing the managerial contract, Cassius Clay described what happened in his first professional fight. "I was so confident that I ate a full dinner only an hour before the fight. I paid for it in the third round when Hunsaker hit me with a heavy blow in the pit of my stomach. To keep me from vomiting, I kept out of his reach until my stomach settled. Then in the final rounds, I shook him up so much he was groggy at the end." Even though Clay had successfully won his first fight, the Louisville sponsorship group felt that more experienced guidance was needed and was necessary. So in November 1960, he was sent to California to train with the legend, the myth, and still fight at the time at the age of 47, Archie Moore.
Their relationship never worked out, and Archie Moore explained, "I knew he was going to be a great fighter, but I wanted him to respect me as a man and as an instructor and fall in line in the learning process. And that seemed to amuse and sometimes anger him. He felt I was ordering him and who I was to order him to do certain things, so he challenged me to spar with him. I didn't accept the challenge. I said, no, I don't box with amateurs. At the time, I was light heavyweight champion of the world, and that's not the way to work with a young man. I was his instructor, not his sparring partner. And there were other things that he didn't take too kindly that were expected of him. We washed our own dishes and did our own cooking at the salt mine. I didn't have the money and the wherewithal, like the big timers, to hire people. So I said to him, you've got to wash the dishes on Wednesday and scrub floors on Thursday, and you can help me cook on Friday. I told him how we divided up the chores. We had other men at the camp, and each person pulled his load. And he said to me, Archie, I didn't come here to be a dishwasher. And I told him, you're not a dishwasher, but you have to carry your own load. And he said, I ain't going to wash no dishes like a woman. So I said to him, okay, you ain't going to eat then. And so he said, all right, he'd wash dishes. And then he looked at me with those pretty eyes and was scowling at me the whole time he was washing. And then the next day came, and it was time to mop the floors. And he said, okay, okay. So he mopped the floors.
Well, the old mongoose, he continued, he said, but just as soon as I thought he was becoming disciplined, he said, I'm tired of this. I want to go home. Christmas was coming up, and he said he wanted to go home for Christmas. Christmas was a good excuse for him to go. And I said, okay, how do you want to go? Do you want to fly? He said, no. No, don't want to go on no plane. I asked, do you want to go on a bus? He said, no, I want to go on a train. So I put him on a train and sent him home to see his folks in Louisville for Christmas. And he never came back again. I had no idea he wasn't going to return. Well, once Clay returned to Louisville, the search for a new trainer began because he was done with Archie. Initially, the sponsoring group, they leaned toward Ernie Breaker, but Breaker was committed to Sugar Ray Robinson at the time. Fred Stoner was considered. He was in his corner for the first fight, but they believed he lacked that experience on the professional level. Finally, William Faversham telephoned Madison Square Garden and asked the president of Madison Square Garden Boxing, who was Harry Markson, for a recommendation, and he suggested Angelo Dundee. Now, Dundee explains how this came about. When Bill Faversham called in December 1960, I was well acquainted with Cassius Clay. Faversham explained the situation to me and came down to Miami with some of his partners to interview me. I liked them. They were satisfied with the training program I had in mind. And then it was time to talk money. They gave me a choice. $125 a week guaranteed or 10% off the top. I took the guarantee, which wasn't the smartest move I've made in my life. Although, after the second Liston fight, we worked on a percentage deal.
Dundee continued and said, anyway, once the money was set, I suggested waiting until after Christmas and then bringing Cassius to Miami to train. That was fine with them, but 10 minutes later, they called back and told me, listen, the kid wants to come to Miami now. He wants to fight. He says, when he's fighting, every day is Christmas. Dundee, who was wise enough to build on his protege's natural gifts, adding ring craft and punching power, all the while Clay was able to fill out into a true heavyweight without losing any of his speed. Under Dundee's shrewd tutelage, Clay made a quick progression through the ranks, and on December the 19th, 1960, Clay began working with Dundee in Miami's 5th Street gym. 8 days later, he knocked out Herb Seiler in the fourth round, and the bond between them was formed. Ali said this years later, Angelo Dundee was with me from my second professional fight, and no matter what happened after that, he was always my friend. He never interfered with my personal life. There was no bossing, no telling me what to do and not do, in or out of the ring. He was there when I needed him, and he always treated me with respect. There just wasn't any problem, ever, between us. Dundee explained what it was like to work with this tremendous young talent, and how easy it was. The fun I had during those early years together was second to none, because it was just me and Muhammad. I had to hire guys out of town to work his corner. Gosh, it was fun. An absolute joy. And that was the whole key to Muhammad. When you have fun, you can excel. Training him was a whole different ball game from most fighters.
And Dundee continued to say, he said, you didn't have to push. It was like jet propulsion. Just touch him and he took off. The important thing was always make him feel like he was the guy. He used to say, Angelo doesn't train me. And I didn't. He was right. I directed him and made him feel that he was the innovator. He'd come out of the ring after a sparring session and I'd say, you threw a great left hook. The way you turned your shoulder with it, your body with it, your toe with it, fantastic. The next time he sparred, he'd throw it that same way. Same thing with his balance and not touching the ropes with his shoulders. These are things I learned from Charlie Goldman, Rocky Marciano's trainer. Make the star feel that he's doing it on his own. Angelo Dundee ran that 5th Street gym, which was owned by his elder brother Chris, and a part of the team was ringside doctor Fernando Ferdi Pacheco, and he said, I'd go over the world with Angelo, watch him work his magic and develop 12 champions. And as the cherry on the cake, he brought in Cassius Clay. Boxing purists were unconvinced by his style, his dazzling footwork and combination. They said his punching power lacked substance. And while gliding around the ring, Clay carried his hands at his side, as if inviting a punch on the jaw, given the impression that he could not be bothered to work on his opponent's body and kept flicking light punches to his opponent's face. His critics claimed he would be exposed and was vulnerable. When Clay was coming to prominence in America, they had clear ideas of how African-American sporting figures should behave. They expected them to be modest and respectful.
Floyd Patterson was the reigning heavyweight champion at the start of the decade and was the essence of the acceptable black face. But Clay would have none of it and took the lead in overturning that stereotype. His third fight was against Tony Esperti, and he knocked him out in the third round. Then he knocked out Jim Robinson in one. Dundee said it was around that time he sparred with Ingemar Johansson. Now that was really something. And we spoke about this in the tale of Patterson versus Johansson, so please do go back and listen to that episode. But in short, Clay made him look average. And at the end of the second round, he was so exhausted that Johansson's trainer, Whitey Bimstein, just called off the sparring session. Gil Rogan, who was then a staff writer for Sports Illustrated, said after the Johansson display that this guy is going to be heavyweight champion someday. You have to write about him. He also remembered his unusual sleeping patterns and he said, I'll tell you something funny. Even when he was young, Ali used to fall asleep sometimes when we were talking. Now when he falls asleep, people assume it's brain damage, but he always did it. With the energy he expended, he had to be tired a lot of the time. He'd be sitting there talking and I'd be taking notes, and soon his voice would start running down like one of those old record players, and then he'd be asleep. He did it a lot, and it didn't surprise me because he did expend so much energy. His whole life was this energetic display that would exhaust absolutely anybody. After the Johansson sparring session, Cassius fought Donny Fleeman, but he couldn't cope with his speed and ended up retiring in the six. Then he went home to Louisville for the Lamar Clark fight and stopped him in the second round.
After that, it was Duke Sabadong from Hawaii, and that went the full 10 rounds with Clay taking the decision. While in Las Vegas for the Sabadong fight, Cassius met Gorgeous George, and Ali recalled the moment years later. I did a radio program with Gorgeous George. First, they asked me about my fight, and I couldn't say I was humble, but I wasn't too loud. Then I asked Gorgeous George about a wrestling match he was having in the same area, and he started shouting, I'ma kill him. I'ma tear his arms off. If this bum beats me, I'll crawl across the ring and cut off my hair. But it's not going to happen because I'm the greatest wrestler in the world. And all the time I was saying to myself, man, I want to see this fight. I don't matter if he wins or loses. I want to be there to see what happens. And the whole place was sold out when Gorgeous George wrestled. There was thousands of people, including me. And that's when I decided I'd never be shy about talking. But if I talked even more, there was no telling how much money people would pay to see me. Cassius had been mouthing off long before we met Gorgeous George. But without question, after the Sabadong fight, he elevated his bragging into an art form. Dundee wasn't bothered by it at all. In fact, he never understood what the problem ever was. He said, the truth is, I never understood the resentment about him popping off. Maybe later, when he got into issues like the war and religion, I could understand it, even though I always believed he had the right to speak his mind. But before that, hey, I remember people complaining about Joe Louis not talking.
Dundee recalled that all a fighter would say in those days was, I'm looking forward to the fight and I'll do my best. That doesn't sell tickets. Muhammad changed the way things work. In promoting boxing, he made the fighter the main guy. You know, it's funny, Muhammad was never as talkative as people thought. In private, even 25 years ago, a lot of the time, he was real thoughtful and quiet, but he knew how to promote himself. God, he could do that. Clay then became the first young fighter who was fresh out of the amateurs to have his bouts televised nationally. Teddy Brenner, who was the matchmaker for Madison Square Garden Boxing at the time, said, the first fight we did together was televised from Louisville, Clay against Alonzo Johnson on July 22nd, 1961. Johnson was a proven fighter, not a big puncher, but experienced and smart. Clay won a 10-round decision, and then we matched him against Alex Mitev. That one was in Louisville too. We felt Clay couldn't punch, and by the fifth round it was an even fight. Mitev figured to come on in the late rounds, because he was a slow starter and a good body puncher. Then in the sixth round, Clay hit him on the chin and knocked him out with one punch. Mitev had never been knocked out before, and in the dressing room afterward, he kept asking what happened. He couldn't believe that Cassius Clay had knocked him out. Clay fought again in Louisville, this time against Willie Besmanov. Before the fight, Clay declared, "I'm embarrassed to get into the ring with this unrated duck. I'm ready for the top contenders like Patterson and Sonny Liston. Besmanov must fall in seven." And that was precisely what happened.
For the first time in recent memory, a fighter was announcing the round in which he would dispose of his opponents and then making good of his prediction. With media attention rapidly growing, Madison Square Garden decided to showcase Clay in New York. His next opponent was Sonny Banks, and he had predicted a fourth round knockout. Gil Clancy was brought in by Dundee as a cornerman for the night, and he explained what happened. He said halfway through the first round, he nailed Cassius on the chin with a left hook, and Cassius went down like a sack of wheat. Angelo turned pale. I thought I was going to have to revive Angelo instead of the fighter. People ask now, what went through my mind when he went down? And the truth is, I've seen lots of fighters go down. I wanted to see if he'd get up, and he did. I think he was more embarrassed than hurt. He got up throwing punches, ran rings around Banks and knocked him out in the fourth round, just like he said he would. Then on December the 28th, 1962, Clay fought Dan Wallner, a tough left hooker from Philadelphia, and he knocked him out in the fourth round. All the reporters wanted to talk about was his prediction, because he had promised everyone it'd be in the fifth. Dundee remembered that Clay told them that Wallner wouldn't shake hands before the fight, which made him mad, and he subtracted one round for poor sportsmanship. On April the 23rd, Clay went to 13 wins and no defeats by knocking out George Logan in Los Angeles. The fight wasn't important, but the trip was, because Los Angeles was where Clay met his good friend, a freelance photographer who worked for Life, Sports Illustrated and numerous other magazines.
Clay said, "Everybody says I love people, so it's only fair that I have the best friend in the world, and that's Howard Bingham. He never asks for anything. He's always there when someone needs him. There's no one like him. He's the best there is. And if you write that, I don't want Howard to think I'm getting soft, so write down that he's lucky I'm his friend too. And tell him I said I'm the only person in the world who likes him." Clay picked up two further stoppage victories against Billy Daniels and Alejandro Lavarante before his toughest test to date came in the form of Archie Moore in California. Now, before the fight, Clay said, "I do notice a lot of press releases and radio statements and TV announcers complaining about how I talk too much and I'm cocky and I need a good beating. And it's true. I do talk a lot, but everything I say, I mean to back up. I notice Archie Moore said the empty wagon makes the most noise. Well, I don't know too much about wagons, but that old man won't go but four rounds with me." Moore responded, "The only way I'll fall in four is by toppling over Clay's prostrate form. He belittles people too much. Even his contemporaries hope I beat the socks off him. As I've said, Clay can go with speed in all directions, including straight down if I hit him properly. I have a good solid right hand that will fit nicely on his chops." They continued to trash talk one another, but there was respect between them. Moore even admitted that he only took the fight for financial reasons. As predicted, Clay stopped the legendary Archie Moore in just four rounds, which made a statement even if the old mongoose was over the hill by that point.
Huge statement, and Moore recalled the fight, and in his own words he said he had a style. He would hit a man a lot of times around the top of the head, and if you hit the top of a man's head, you shake up his thought pattern. You disturb his thoughts, A fighter has to think. But if someone is plucking you on the top of the head, you can't think properly or correctly. And this is what he did. He made me dizzy and he knocked me out. Moore hinted that Clay could have even beaten him when he was in his prime. Now he says, people ask me, if I'd fought Clay when I was young, would the outcome have been different? I don't think so. One never knows for sure, but I told you before, Ali would have beaten Joe Lewis 4 times out of 5. And I was a pretty good light heavyweight. But I think Joe Lewis would have beaten me. Well, 2 months after defeating Archie Moore, Cassius Clay stopped Charlie Powell in Pittsburgh, knocking him out, as predicted, in the 3rd round. Clay had now captured the public imagination and expectations were running high. 7 of his previous 8 fights had ended in the predicted round, and his poetry was being widely quoted. Even Life magazine published an entire poem. He returned to Madison Square Garden in New York for a fight against Doug Jones. Clay declared, "This boy likes to mix, so he must fall in 6. The night before the fight, Clay was in his hotel room telling a guy sent by Bobby Nelson, Sugar Ray's brother-in-law, that same rhyme. The man was known as Fast Black or Bundini. And this is what he replied. He said, you can't predict no rounds. You fixing them, you phony. Drew Bundini Brown had been with Sugar Ray for 5 years, but he admired everything Clay was doing at the time. But he was convinced that something fishy was going on.
He said, you can't be predicting all them rounds. Then he asked, tell me the truth. You'll get together and fix them fights, don't you? You gotta be fixing them, or else you couldn't tell Archie Moore when he was falling. You couldn't have told Powell. You've gotta be a phony. You either a phony, or Shorty's in your corner. Now Shorty is Bundini's name, for God. I've been with Sugar Ray. I was with Johnny Bratton. I never heard of anybody predicting weeks in advance the round they're going to win in. Tell me the truth. Tell me the truth. Clay recalled that. I sat down next to him. You know what the truth is, I said? The truth is, every time I go into the ring, I'm scared to death. He looked at me as though he was shocked. Then tears began to flow down his cheeks. I knew Shorty was with you. Shorty had to be with you. He grabbed me and kissed me on the jaw. You mean you actually scared out there? Why? I'm scared, I told him, because after all that popping off, all that predicting, all those people wanting to see me get whipped, I know I'm in trouble. If I lose, they'll be ready to run me out of this country. I'm out on a limb, and I know I gotta win. I'm on the spot when I'm out there, and I'm scared to death. Now that's a fact that you, that only you and me know. You and me and Shorty," Bundini whispered. "What you predicting about your fight tomorrow? You gonna whip Doug Jones? Round 6, but I don't know whether I can do it or not." Bundini's reply was, "You gonna win that fight?" he shouted. "I don't know if you're gonna knock him out, but you're gonna win."
He then asked Clay, "Put me in your corner." "Why?" I asked. "'Cause you got the power and I got the spirit. You a heavyweight, Sugar Ray. You're going to be next champion. You'll beat Sonny Liston, all right? Am I in your corner?" "All right," I told him. "You're in my corner, if you want to be." That was the first I'd seen of Drew Bundini Brown, who would become one of my crew. Later, Clay's forecast was actually adjusted by 2 rounds. He says, "I'm changing the pick I made before. Instead of 6, Doug goes in 4. So Clay ended up having an off night and he produced one of his worst performances as a professional, while Jones fought one of his best fights. The result was a boring fight, lacking in entertainment and value. Once the 4th round passed and the crowd turned against Clay, as if he had lost, which he almost did actually, both judges scored about 5 rounds to 4 in Clay's favour, with 1 round even. The referee marked his scorecard 8-1-1 to Clay. After the bout, he tried to remain upbeat. And Clay said, the referee was the most accurate. See, I'm as pretty as a girl. There isn't a mark on me. As for his incorrect prediction, he told reporters, first, I called it in six. Then I called it in four. Four and six. That's 10, right? Ali later admitted, when it was over, I had won. But it was close, and the audience threw everything they had in their hands in the ring. Cups, bottles, peanuts, even a switchblade. And they booed me all the way to the dressing room and clutched at my robe. I just made more enemies, but every one of them would find a way to see me fight again.
Following the poor performance, he ended up taking a battering from the press due to his vainness and comical boastfulness. Because he took great delight in predicting the round in which he would finish off his opponent and chanted a rhyme to the media, it was easy to attack him with a pen or a typewriter. They now called him Gaseous Cassius before he headed off to London in June 1963 to fight the British champion, Henry Cooper, known for his devastating left hand. Ali said years later, I flew to London. I fell in love with the people in England. I had never been treated so warm, so friendly, and I had always said England was my second home. Even though I'd come to destroy their champion, they treated me with a kindness and courtesy I had never felt in Louisville or any city in America. They even criticised the Queen for meeting with Henry Cooper, but not with me. Now, we have been through this fight on numerous different platforms. We've done it in Henry Cooper's career profile, the tale of Clay versus Liston, so we're not going to go over it again. So in summary, Clay taunted the British press that their hero would fall in five. And he recalled, on the night before the Cooper fight, I had announced that I was the uncrowned king of the heavyweights, and Jack Solomon, the old English promoter, took me to a theatrical outfitter who made up a king's crown for my head and a royal robe. I wore it at the weigh-in and announced to the crowd, I'm the king of the world. Henry Cooper is only a warm-up, just a stepping stone for me to get my real crown. You know that? I'm the next king. The king of all boxers.
Ali continued to say that now that I look back, I'm surprised at the sense of humour they had. They seemed to understand what I was doing even more than the people back home. They knew I was campaigning. This ain't no jive. Henry Cooper will fall in five. I had the figure five printed on a large card and flashed it across the room. And I held up five fingers. Cooper will fall in five. He walked into the Wembley ring that night in front of 55,000 screaming fans with Dundee's warning to be wary of Henry Cooper's, devastating left hook still ringing in his ears. But at the end of the fourth round, Cooper floored Clay with that left hook. But he was saved by the bell that no one heard because the Wembley Stadium was just in absolute anarchy and uproar. He gained some precious extra seconds to recover, as Dundee will explain. He split his glove on the seam near the thumb. Actually, it happened in the first round. I spotted the tear then and told him, keep your hand closed. I didn't want anyone to see it because everything was going our way. Then at the end of the fourth round, he got nailed. Cassius was hurt, no doubt about it. He got hit with that left hook on the button. So when he came back to the corner, I gave him some smelling salts. One of the corner men put ice on his back and down around his lower extremities to give him some feel. Then I helped the split a little, pulled it to the side and made the referee aware that there was a torn glove. I don't know how much time that gave us, maybe a minute, but it was enough. If we hadn't got on that extra time, I don't know what would have happened.
Dundee added, I think Cassius would have made it through, but we don't have to answer that question because the horsehair really was coming out of the glove. No extra gloves were available, so the bout resumed with the split seam, and Clay stopped Cooper in the fifth round, just as he had predicted. He then proudly proclaimed, I'm not the greatest, I'm the double greatest. Not only do I knock him out, I pick the round. I'm the boldest, the prettiest, the most superior, most scientific, most skillfulest fighter in the ring today. I'm the onlyest fighter who goes from corner to corner and club to club debating with fans. I've received more publicity than any fighter in history. I talk to reporters till their fingers are sore. Now, straight after the fight, head of Clay's consortium, William Faversham, went to visit his fighter in the dressing room with Jack Nylon, Sonny Liston's manager, and said, "He's bringing us a message from Liston." Nylon said, "I've flown 3,000 miles just to tell you that Liston wants you, and he's got a message for you. He says to please drink your orange juice and your milkshakes, stay well and healthy. You've talked yourself into a world heavyweight title fight. Now your wife can be a rich widow." Now, we have described the lead up to the fight, the incident at the Thunderbird Casino, Clay taunting Liston during a public workout and outside his home in Denver. We've also spoken of both fights in great detail when recording our tale of Sonny Liston and Cassius Clay. So please, if you want to listen to more of them stories, go back and listen to that episode. Now, rather than go over that ground again, we're going to try and summarise this in a few paragraphs, starting with Ali's short description of what he had to do to get this world heavyweight title shot.
So he said, "For 6 months, I dogged Liston's every step, challenging, predicting his doom, calling him the big ugly bear, making it impossible for him or the newspapers to ignore me. In all my campaigning, I found a way to force the promoters to give me a title fight. And he got it. Clay was finally getting his shot at the world heavyweight title against the champion Sonny Liston, who was still currently in between fights with Floyd Patterson as well. After defeating Cooper, Clay was now the leading contender for the heavyweight title. But there had been an ominous change at the top. In September 1962, Liston, a fearsome ex-hoodlum who learned how to box while in prison, he actually annihilated Floyd Patterson inside a round to claim the heavyweight crown. They have their rematch in July 1963. Liston and gave Patterson another beating, battering him senseless in the first round. Even those who could recall such legendary sluggers as Jack Johnson, Jack Dempsey, and even more recently your Joe Lewis's and your Rocky Marcianos would shudder at the sight of Liston. With his ball-like torso and his sledgehammer fists, Liston was chilling. A boxing journalist gave explicit descriptions of this unsavoury champion, who we may add, this is all publicity. We love, Sean, we love Liston. I know you do. We absolutely adore this man. The person they portray is not the guy he was. But one painted Liston as an arrogant, mean, rude, and altogether frightening. He was described as the last man anyone would want to meet in the dark alley. And this was the man who stood between young, a very young Cassius Clay, and his dream. The inevitable Liston-Clay fight was finally arranged on February the 25th, 1964, at a convention centre in Miami. Clay kept up his constant barrage of taunts about how he was going to whoop that big ugly bear, and later recalled the significance of the fight. "I remember that morning, 3 days before my fight for the world heavyweight title, coming out of my house at 4610 Northwest 15th Court to go over the 5th Street Gym. I have this eerie feeling that I'm at a crossroads of something I have to pass through, or I'll never come this far again."
Well, he wasn't wrong. This fight would not only change his fortunes as a boxer, but would pave the way for the birth of Muhammad Ali. Interestingly, Ali also acknowledged that through his harassment of Liston, in his words, "he discovered something new and even more valuable to me than the World Heavyweight Championship," he recalled. "In a few hours, I'll find out what it is. This fight will come closer to being cancelled than any of my fights before or since." Ali recalled, "The first inkling I get that this day will be different from any other day of my life comes when Angelo burst into the dressing room, a look of horror on his face. Do you know who's out there?" He half opens the door and points to Malcolm X standing near the ring, looking at old fight posters. "You know what will happen if the newspapers pick that up? They'll denounce you. They'll condemn you. They'll wreck the fight. Please, please," his eyes wide with fear, "we've got to get him out of here. If the newspapers know you're associated with Muslims like Malcolm X, your career is over. Do you hear me? I've been as close to Angelo as I've ever been to a white man up to now, and the only thing he doesn't know is that Malcolm is not the only X in the gym. I am Cassius X. I too am a follower of the Honourable Elijah Muhammad. Angelo sees he is making no impression and abruptly turns away and leaves. Dundee contacts his brother Chris, who relays the situation to Bill McDonald, the promoter, and from there, things escalated. McDonald advised Clay to disavow his religion by making a public statement, but he refused and was ready to give up his world title shot for his religious beliefs.
Yeah, Clay, then he received a phone call from Chris Dundee just as he was about to leave town. He said the fight's back on, McDonald is gonna have it. Everybody talked to him. You don't have to disavow your religion. And Clay remembered, I say, that's the only way I'll go. The fight's on. We'll talk about the details later. Now it's up to you. It was always up to you. You know what the odds are. And he decided, he was literally packing his bag into that big red bus of his with all his powers. They were gone. So the headlines in the Palm Beach Post declared, Liston 7-4, favourite to prove Cassius is a hoax. And the Gazette wrote that the newsman back Liston 43-4. So he was a heavy, heavy favourite. At the weigh-in in the morning of the fight, Clay appeared to go berserk. He hurled insults at Liston and lunged at him, shouting, I'm ready to rumble now. His handlers, well, they had to restrain him. It's just beautiful. It's all play. When Clay's pulse and blood pressure were checked, they soared almost off the scale as well, apparently. The doctor who examined him offered his opinion. He said, this fighter is scared to death. Well, Ali testified. The truth of the matter is, I rehearsed and planned every move I made that day. Of course he did. Legend. An hour later, both vital signs were normal, and Clay was perfectly composed. His corner man asked him why he had put on such a wild act, to which Clay replied, because Liston thinks I'm a nut. He's scared of no man, but he's scared of a nut. On the night of the fight, Clay's younger brother is fine on the undercard, and he recalls, says Clay's ready for the biggest fight of his night. His brother's on the undercard. He says, I come rushing up to the bleachers, standing next to a woman who says to me, young man, shouldn't you be in the dressing room getting ready? We come here to see you fight Liston. But I'm yelling encouragement down to Rudy, hollering at the top of my voice, jab him, keep moving. Rudy, keep moving. The sweat is pouring off of me.
Ali recalled, I feel Dr. Pacheco tugging at my arm. Champ, you need all the rest you can get. For God's sake, you go on in 30 minutes. Rudy wins the fight by a split decision, and Clay announces, you're through fighting. I'm going to be the champ tonight. You're not going to have to fight anymore, but it will be a long time before he listens to me. When the fighters entered the ring at 10 p.m. that night, observers were struck by two facts. First, Clay was as cool as a cucumber. Second, he was much bigger than he had appeared in their imagination, and Liston correspondingly smaller. At just over 210 pounds, the magnificently sculptured Clay was only 7 pounds, the lighter man, and as he drew himself up to the full 6'3" frame during the centre ring preliminaries, he looked down on an opponent who no longer looked quite so formidable. At the bell, Clay began skipping clockwise around the ring while Liston plodded forward, hurling punches that found only thin air. Clay kept dancing around him, but then began flicking out left jabs, first singly, and then in flurries, with an occasional chopping right hand for good measure. Clay stuck to these hit-and-run tactics, and by the end of round two, those who had predicted that Clay would be on a life support machine by this stage were left flabbergasted. During the third round, Clay opened up a nasty cut under Liston's left eye, but near the end of that round, it could be seen that Clay had a problem with his eyes. They were stinging so badly that Clay begged Dundee to cut off his gloves and end the fight, but he was persuaded to return to the contest.
However, Liston was now finding the range and Clay took a number of heavy blows as he retreated, improvising desperately while he waited for his sight to return. Somehow he survived, and by the end of the round, his eyes were fired. Whether a stinging antiseptic had been spread on Liston's gloves between rounds or whether there was another explanation, we will never know. But once Clay could see, Liston's chance had gone. In the sixth round, Clay changed his tactics and went toe-to-toe with the champion. At the end of the round, Liston told his corner that he had had enough and refused to come out for the seventh. Sonny Liston, the mighty Sonny Liston, surrendered his title sitting on the stool, later blaming a damaged shoulder, a decision that haunted him until his death just 6 years later. When Clay realised what had just happened, he was on his feet and shouting at the assembled boxing writers at ringside, "I am the king. I am the king. King of the world. Eat my words. Eat my words." And of course, his famous words, "I am the greatest. I am the greatest. I'm the king of the world. I shook up the world." A few years later, and Ali was asked if he thought Sonny Liston quit. And he said, "Did Liston really hurt his shoulder? I can't say for sure, but I don't think so." He then spoke of the moment his eyes began to burn. "My eyes burned bad in the fifth round. I could see a little, but not much. I wanted to stop. Angelo pushed me out, and I never knew for sure what caused the problem." Interestingly, though, Ali does admit something, that he was offered a stimulant to use later on in his career.
"Well, he does recall, before I fought Larry Holmes, a man from Philadelphia came to me. He had a bottle with a yellow liquid inside. He didn't ask for money. All he said was that he wanted to help, and he told me, 'Put this on your gloves if you get in trouble. It won't hurt Holmes, but it will blind him temporarily.' I said no, that it would be against my religion. I would never try to win a fight that way. But when we had that conversation, it reminded me of my fight against Sonny Liston. 26 years. I can't believe all that time has gone by. When I listened to the tapes, what I said that night, I was great, but man, I was crazy." The next day, the new champion sprang a further surprise to his critics at a press conference and announced that he had joined the Nation of Islam. Clay preached about Islam and how it was a peaceful religion before explaining, "I'm a good boy. I never have done anything wrong. I've never been in jail. I've never been in court. I don't join any integration marches. I don't pay any attention to all those white women who wink at me. I don't carry signs. I don't impose myself on people who don't want me. If I go into somebody's house where I'm not welcome, I'm uncomfortable, so I stay away. I like white people. I like my own people. They can live together without infringing on each other. You can't condemn a man for wanting peace. If you do, you condemn peace itself. A rooster crows only when it sees the light. Put him in the dark and he'll never crow. I have seen the light and I'm crowing."
It was no secret they had been flirting with the so-called black Muslims, but they would deliberately antagonise white America at the very moment it was rising to salute him, left even his closest supporters gasping. His mother, Odessa, said, "When he joined the Nation of Islam, I felt, well, this is the land of the free, worship as you please. If that's what he wanted to do, it was all right. The important thing was he had a belief in God." What people must remember is that Clay had already begun to get a better understanding of the religion from the very start of his professional career. And he said, "While in Miami in 1961, I was training for a fight and I met a follower of Elijah Muhammad named Captain Sam. And he invited me to a meeting. And after that, my life changed." Now, for us to understand, we must hear from the man himself, and we're going to, this is literally from his book. This is him, Muhammad Ali, talking about his, I suppose, his epiphany and what changed his life. He said, "The first time I felt truly spiritual in my life was when I walked into the Muslim temple in Miami. A man named Brother John was speaking the first words. I heard him say, 'Why are we called Negroes? It's the white man's way of taking away our identity. If you see a Chinaman coming, you know he's from China. If you see a Cuban coming, you know he's from Cuba. If you see a Canadian coming, you know he comes from Canada. What country is called Negro? Then Brother John said, we don't even have our names. And I said to myself, what's he talking about? I've got my name. But I kept listening. And he explained,
we were named after our white slave masters. If Mr. Jones had 50 slaves, there were Mr. Jones's niggers, and they were named after him. Then if Mr. Washington bought those slaves, they become Mr. Washington's niggers and changed to his name. That was plain to me. I could reach out and touch what Brother John was saying. It wasn't like church teaching, where I had to have faith that what the preacher was preaching was right. And I said to myself, Cassius Marcellus Clay. He was a Kentucky white man who owned my great-granddaddy and named my great-granddaddy after him. And then when my granddaddy got named, and then my daddy, and now it's me. Jeremiah Shabazz was a teacher of their version of the religion, and he explained that, contrary to what had been portrayed in the movies and written in some books, Malcolm X was not Clay's first teacher. The person to educate him first regarding Islam and the teachings of Elijah Muhammad was our minister in Miami, Ismail Sabakan. This is what Ali said about Malcolm X. He said Malcolm was a very intelligent, with a good sense of humour, wise man. When he talked, he held me spellbound for hours. He introduced me to his wife and children. Then he sent a friend of his, Archie Robinson, to act as sort of an administrator or road manager. Archie looked over my contract and helped run the training camp. But anything that had to do with boxing, like choosing sparring partners, was still decided by me and Angelo. Clay was taught that the white man was the devil, and Shabazz admitted that Clay questioned everything he was taught. In hindsight, it was obvious why he chose the religion due to the outright racism of the time. But there's no one better to explain this decision than the man himself.
This is what he said. For 3 years, up until I thought Sonny Liston, I'd sneak into the Nation of Islam meetings through the back door. I didn't want people to know I was there. I was afraid if they knew, I wouldn't be allowed to fight for the title. Later on, I learned to stand up for my beliefs. And since then, my beliefs have changed. I don't believe in Mr. Yaqub and the spaceship anymore. Hearts and souls have no colour. I know that too. But Elijah Muhammad was a good man, even if he wasn't the messenger of God we thought he was. If you look at what our people were like then, a lot of us didn't have self-respect. We didn't have banks or stores. We didn't have anything after being in America for hundreds of years. Elijah Muhammad was trying to lift us up and get our people out of the gutter. He made people dress properly, so they weren't on the streets looking like prostitutes and pimps. He taught good eating habits and was against alcohol and drugs. I think he was wrong when he talked about white devils, but part of what he did was make people feel it was good to be black. So I'm not apologising for what I believed. I'm wiser now, but so are a lot of other people. And I think that's a great quote from Mr. Ali. It just shows you, Elijah Muhammad, you look into him a bit, the guy isn't the nicest of guys, but he done something for Ali, and Ali understood and realised that, and it's incredible what he did, really. I can't help but just have absolute respect for him. So then on March 6th, during a radio broadcast from Chicago, Elijah Muhammad announced, this Clay name has no divine meaning. I hope he will accept being called by a better name. Muhammad Ali is what I will give him for as long as he believes in Allah and follows me. Of course, Muhammad Ali, Cassius Clay, accepted the name, and he said, changing my name was one of the most important things that happened to me in my life. It freed me from the identity given to my family by slave masters.
Now, this is the point where we're going to break off for the first part of the Muhammad Ali story. This is 1942 to 1964 we've covered so far, and we will be following it on from 1964 all the way up until he passes in 2016 in the next episode. And we hope you've enjoyed this episode so far, because we feel we've told some different stories and we've given a lot more perspective from Ali himself. And we've given perspectives from his father, from his mother, people that have not been included into any of the shows that we've done where Ali's been involved in them in some way, shape or form. So we hope you've enjoyed the first part. And of course, now we're up to the point where we're going to move into the second part of his career, where things really start to pick up, where we get the second Liston fight and then things start to progress even more. We get the exile moments. We, of course, get his return to boxing. We get the fight of the century, the rumble in the jungle. We've got so much more to cover. And then his back end of his career. And then as time goes on, the development of Parkinson's, everything that he has to go through, and his passing. Of course, there's so much more to cover. But so far, it's been fantastic. And I hope you guys have enjoyed listening to it.
I've enjoyed every minute of it. I'll be honest with you, it's been great. Just reading out these wonderful quotes and these major moments in Muhammad Ali's life-changing moments. And although I always heard of the restaurant story, he was told he had to leave, they wouldn't serve him. I mean, that was about as much information as I ever really got. I see a bit in the film, but didn't really go into great detail. But to actually hear the words from Ali's coming out of his book, if you like, and then the fight with the bikers after, stuff I never knew. And it was a real eye-opener, and I thought I had to be there, because I don't ever hear anyone even mention that fight. You hear the racism, you hear the medal being thrown away, but there's not enough depth and detail in there. So we hope we've provided that for you, because I didn't know that myself. So it was great being able to do that and go relay that. So yeah, I hope you're enjoying it. It's a great story. I mean, Muhammad Ali, absolute legend. And the quotes get better. The attitude is brilliant. It's everything about the guy. It's sensational. The second part's going to be even better.
Absolutely. We're very much looking forward to delivering the second part of the Muhammad Ali career profile. If you've enjoyed part one, please let us know on social media at @career_profiles on Twitter or the BTR Boxing Podcast Network across Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, TikTok. Please make sure you let us know if you've enjoyed this episode. Please, if you're also a patron, please let us know if you've enjoyed the episode. You'll have had early access to it, ad-free version of this episode as well. So please do contact us and let us know that you've enjoyed the episode. We really do appreciate all of the feedback. But we will be back with the next episode. Please make sure you tune in, because it will be delivered next week. Thank you so much for listening to the first part of the Muhammad Ali career profile.
Ali, he knows how to talk and he knows how to fight, and all the contenders will beat out of sight. Sing Muhammad, Muhammad Ali, he floats like a butterfly, stings like a bee. Muhammad, the black Superman, who calls to the other guy.
Sports Social Podcast Network.